Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Brownlee. I'm joined tonight by a man who stands on a wall, so you don't have to. Doug.
That's right. It's like, I want you not to lie to me. Well, you can't handle the opposite of what lying is. Well, I think I'm entitled to it because lying is bad. Well, you're going to get the opposite of lying, which is the truth.
Doug, you have not been on the podcast in a while.
I know, I'm a little rusty, as evidenced by my opening salvo.
I have missed you. Welcome back.
Thank you. My heart's breaking just a little bit.
You can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com, where we have new content every day, including the last few days, I guess, of 30 Stars of Summer. Watch a movie starring an actor on our calendar, which you can find at fthismovie.blogspot.com. Write a review. A number of people have been participating really regularly, some every day or close to it. So thank you to everybody who's taken part. It has been fun, but also a bit of a chore.
We had this idea a long time ago. It's like, that'd be so fun. And like clear out your DVR and see the movies that you've always wanted to see that you never had the excuse to see them. And now it just becomes work.
Right. Like it's great for you because like you have a movie that we're going to talk about momentarily. I'm sure that you had DVR'd and it was like, hey, the star of this movie is on my DVR. I can watch this. However, am like seeking out Gold Diggers, The Secret of Bear Mountain, putting it on my DVR for the express purpose of watching it on Christina Ricci Day.
Patrick had to seek out this movie he owns on four different platforms, including DivX and Laserdisc. Yeah, The Secret of Bear Mountain.
Every time a new technology comes out, I wait to see how Secret of Bear Mountain looks.
You bookmarked it in Prime.
You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter. Be one of the 400 plus followers on Twitter. Twitter.com/fthismovie.
It's kind of ramped up maybe because of this 30 Stars of Summer. And
maybe
I'm reaching out.
Maybe because of Pam Grier. What do you think about that, who follows us on Twitter?
She definitely retweeted us when we said, please retweet this link, when I think she was day six or seven or something.
And Pam Grier is nothing if not compliant. She's like, listen, this thing asked me to retweet it, and I kind of lisped unasked. I don't know what happened. Thing asked me to retweet. That's how Pam Grier talks, everyone.
Wait, am I talking to coffee right now?
She's all like, hey, I can't lisp on sugar. I wanted to lisp on sugar because she calls people sugar. But yeah, you can't really do it. So maybe coffee should just say, see you on the thee-thaw.
baby talk. It's a wonder. Coffee can walk.
You can find us at DVDVerdictPresents.com or DVDVerdict.com by clicking on the movie podcast tab at the top of the page. And while you're there, click on any number of DVD and Blu-ray releases and purchase some movies through the Amazon links to support DVD Verdict. You can find our 100 most recent episodes in the iTunes store. But remember, for all of our episodes, you have to go to fthismovie.blogspot.com. Mm. Douglas, it has been a long time since you've been on the show. Have you seen anything good lately?
I have not nearly seen as much as you have. I'm impressed because with a new baby and an old baby, what? You're old.
That's a weird way to refer to my wife.
You've not only been keeping up to speed with 30 Stars of Summer, you've not only been doing podcasts regularly on an alternate movie, but you've also seen a lot of the summer stuff. And I'm impressed by that because you've posted reviews on our site and your other day job, which is comedians.about.com. And I have really dropped the ball. I have not seen a lot of the summer stuff. So I'm hoping by the summer show, I just do a weird marathon in my own way that I seek stuff out and hopefully it comes out on DVD or whatever. But I've only been seeing stuff lately that's part of the whole 30 Stars of Summer. But I have seen, to your point, I have seen a lot of good movies lately. They're just part of, you know, the same actor base that everyone else has seen. But yesterday I saw Chinatown, which was great. Yeah. I feel like I've seen maybe half of it before or most of it, but don't remember it because it was probably, 20 years ago. I saw The Third Man, which was also excellent. I saw a lot of other things that were not so memorable, as evidenced by me not.
You saw Bull Durham for the first time.
Oh yeah, I did see that. That's great. And I want to listen to
Dirty Harry. I'm just remembering what you reviewed. Yeah, you saw good stuff.
I tried to, and there's a couple, you know, a couple.
Is this?
I saw Margot at the wedding. That, and actually, it's funny because my wife really, really liked it, and I was like, no, this makes me like very sad and just alone and depressed and feeling alone. And
yeah.
And I get that they're real. I'm using finger quotes right now. Real characters, and that real characters have real responses to things. And I know that everything can't be, you know, the cliched happy ending. But that movie really just was. I felt it was grating. I felt very kind of turned off by it. Yeah.
Well, that was the first movie that Noah Baumbach had made after The Squid and the Whale. And in The Squid and the Whale, when the characters are horrible to one another, you sort of get it because they're part of this specific community. They're intellectuals. They have this weird superiority complex. And there are characters in the movie who help ground it who aren't necessarily horrible to one another, like the Jesse Eisenberg or the Owen Klein characters, because they're kids and they have yet to be corrupted by the influence of their awful parents, so that you have sort of a way in. And I felt like Margot at the Wedding, which I was really excited to see, and then I saw it, and I don't hate it, but I don't particularly love it. There's no way in. It's just people who are horrible to one another.
Yeah, and it's funny because a lot of the, I mean, the cast, Jennifer Jason Leigh, that's the Jennifer Jason Leigh day. That's why I saw it.
Yeah, yeah.
Nicole Kidman, who seems to be playing that part an awful lot of, like, kind of this shrill, you know, uptight, you know, full of herself, whatever.
Part
Jack
cat.
Black. Yeah. Jack Black, who tried to do something but still comes across as Jack Black. Like,
right.
I just want him to do, I hate to sound simplistic about it, but if you just did a different way of speaking almost too, that might help him get into a different character, because the way he talks is like very much, you know, him performing, like he's very, you know, like outgoing and whatever. And Jennifer Jason Leigh, who's great. And there's a couple other characters who I don't know offhand, but, it really just, yeah, I don't hate it, but it just was kind of like, oh, I also saw, I'm trying to think, what's that movie I saw that, I think you recommended to me that, it was,
Your Friends and Neighbors.
Your friends, wow, you are good because you're going off of the clues I just gave you right now.
Well, because we're talking about Margot at the Wedding and you're talking about a movie where characters are horrible to one another.
Like, right.
There's no movie where characters are more horrible to one another than Your Friends and Neighbors.
And I saw that for Catherine Keener Day, I think. That was earlier in the month. And I had heard about it. And again, it was one of those things, kind of like Margot at the Wedding, like an indie you know, not a typical traditional Hollywood type movie, but those kinds of movies sometimes, and I know, like, I'm just like everyone else, like sometimes you have to really gear yourself up to watch something that you know is not going to be, especially, and I hate to sound stupid, but on like a Sunday when I'm like, okay, I'm going to start the week on a good note. You can't watch like something that's going to make you feel like it's 10 o'clock. I have to go to bed. And now I feel just angry or just like disturbed because Jason Patrick gave this speech about how he had sex with a guy in high school. And it's very, I mean, that's a great speech.
Yeah.
You know, but the movie itself is just, again, horrible characters treating each other horribly. So
did you feel like it was weird that Jason Patrick took the time to give that speech while his cruise ship was out of control?
Yes.
See, it was worth getting right, wasn't it?
Cruise control, baby.
Do you remember where you were when Rush Hour hit the water? Because I do. Let me tell you something. I saw Speed 2 at like a dollar theater second run. I had to pee worse than I've ever had to pee in my life. I was in agony. I had to pee so bad, but I refused to get up and miss 1 second of Speed 2 cruise control.
Impressive. What happened to Jason Patrick? Because honestly,
I'll tell you what happened to him. Speed 2 cruise control.
But it's a weird thing though, because he is like a, you know, kind of quantitatively handsome man,
mm-hmm.
Who can act as well, if not better, than most other male actors. But he is just, you know, we just kind of push him to the side, and he's nowhere now, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of does character parts or like smaller movies. He was in Narc a couple of years ago, which is like a pretty kick-ass movie. But if the stories that Joe Carnahan has told about Narc are to be believed, he is not easy to work with. And perhaps that has affected his career. Yeah, he was maybe unprepared, didn't have lines memorized.
I heard a rumor that Faye Dunaway on Chinatown, another great movie, which I can't even begin to talk about because it's been talked about a billion times.
Yeah, right,
Do we have a podcast on Chinatown?
No.
I wouldn't be surprised if you and JB did one a year and a half ago, and I just, like, the site that I myself work for would be like, what? Is there a I guess Faye Dunaway was such a witch with a B that she would make people like flush her toilet for her.
Wow. Wow. Weird.
I want to get to that level just in my regular job. Like, Doug, you're not even important here.
Are you
like, flush my toilet.
Are you suggesting that she deserved to be boned by her dad?
I'm suggesting that she got the Oedipus right in the back of the head with the bullet. The thing with the, you know, like incest. When
yeah,
you
the Oedipus.
It, and you
yeah.
cut your eye out or something. I don't know.
Yeah, no, you got it. Oedipus, cut your eye, bullet. I'm pretty sure. Now we don't need to do a Chinatown podcast. I have seen a new movie.
Spoilers for Chinatown.
I have seen a new movie every day in June, but not many that I've liked because I'm finding, as I said, I think on the podcast last week with Alex, that a lot of these actors that were chosen, like I've seen the movies that they've been in that I wanted to see, so I'm left with weird leftovers like, oh, there aren't a lot of Whoopi Goldberg movies that I've always meant to get around to seeing. So I'll DVR Eddie, where she coaches the Knicks. The New York Knicks. Yeah. She's Eddie. Don't confuse it with The Associate. I don't know what she does in that movie, but they came out around the same time.
We're recording this, this drops on Wednesday, but today is the Melanie Griffith day and I'm finding it hard. I don't know what I'm going to watch because there's not a lot on Netflix and a lot of stuff that I haven't seen. I don't want to see for a reason.
Can you Redbox Now and Then? Is there any way to get Now and Then in your hands?
Listen, F this.
By
F,
the
F
end F of heads. Business.
Listen, F heads, F this movie fans. Patrick had a mad crush on Gabby Hoffman. In 1995. It's a weird thing he doesn't like to talk about, but of all the little young starlets in that movie, he chose Gabby Hoffman, who has gone on.
She's going places.
Yeah.
No, not so much.
She has never been chained to a radiator, as far as I know.
I should have hitched my wagon to the Ashley Aston Moore train.
Yes.
Playing the young Rita Wilson. She also shows up in a small role in Gold Diggers, The Secret of Bear Mountain. She's the Pesci to Christina Ricci's De Niro. Listen, there are two movies that I want to talk about very quickly. One is a movie that I watched on Netflix called Don't Go in the Woods. It came out last year, very limited release, one of those kind of video on demand, maybe some midnight screenings. Co-written by and directed by one Vincent D'Onofrio, which is maybe its only claim to fame. It's a horror movie that was billed as like a musical horror movie. And that intrigued me because I've never seen a musical horror movie unless you count Repo, the genetic opera.
I count Cannibal the Musical.
I suppose. And also that it was directed by Vincent D'Onofrio, who seems to be kind of a crazy person. So I was like, well, this movie's going to be interesting, right?
Sure.
Incorrect. It is not interesting. What it is like he hooked up with some indie band that's not without talent. Their songs are sort of emo, acoustic. They're good songs.
Okay.
He brought them into the woods and filmed them jamming for about an hour. In different combinations. Sometimes they're around a campfire. Sometimes they're by a tree. And then in the last half hour, like, people start killing each other. It was so painfully boring and disappointing. And most of the songs are just sort of diegetic, where it's just like the band is playing a song. It's not like a character bursts into song as they're about to be murdered or something, which is what I was hoping for, you know?
Yeah.
No, just a band hanging out in the woods playing. It was kind of like eating lunch at a Potbelly.
And there's a guy in the fake balcony above the entrance.
Right, just playing like a Jack Johnson song. You're like, I'm trying to eat my wreck sandwich.
Skinny wreck, please.
So listen, I'm diabetic. I gotta cut back on the carbs.
Tighten that shit up.
Exactly. The other movie that I want to talk about is a new movie called Seeking a Friend for the End of the World.
Ooh.
Which is playing in somewhat limited release and finished, I think, 10th at the box office this weekend, and everyone's calling it this massive disappointment. And I'm fascinated by that because it's a miracle that this movie got made, much less released in the summer, because the summer is not a movie, you know, that's the time when people want to go see Transformers, where Chicago is destroyed, but it's like for our entertainment, and Seeking a Friend for the End of the World says, the world's going to end, and that's not for our entertainment. Like, everyone's right. going to die. I really, really liked it, and it's getting mostly bad reviews, and I wonder how much of that is due to the fact that it brings people down. Maybe in a month that they don't want to be brought down, they will go to the movies to be entertained by that funny Steve Carell guy, and instead they leave feeling kind of sad.
What month? I mean, this is going to sound like a weird question, but what month should it have come out in, or what month do you think it would have come out in?
I think it might have fared better, yeah, during like sort of award season when people's they kind of shift gears a little bit, you know, and they're in the mood for something else. Maybe not. I mean, maybe this movie never was going to be entirely successful because it's a weird mix of like sad and comedy. And it's a mix that I really like. I like how seriously it sort of takes the premise, how much it follows through on the premise. There's a bunch of really good, I mean, every 5 minutes a new person shows up that like, hey, I know that guy. There's Jerry from Parks and Recreation. This is fun. But I said this to you, I think, on the phone maybe. There are things in the movie that had this really profound sort of emotional impact on me. I cried through about the last half hour of the movie, which isn't to say that the whole last half hour is sad. I just was really affected. I found myself crying through a lot of it. Also, I'm a bit of a Nancy.
Pretty pussy.
However... I left feeling like the movie really affected me. But I think I said to you, I don't know if going back and seeing it a second time removed from that, if the movie would hold up, if it's as good as I think it is. I don't know.
I really want to see the movie badly. I haven't yet. And I remember when the preview first came out and I featured it in a little column that will return to form next week this week.
Shitting on the trailers with Doug?
Shitting on the trailers with Doug.
Shitting on Doug in a trailer.
So I featured it in, I don't know when the trailer came out, 6 months ago, whatever. And I really responded to a lot of, trailers obviously are hit or miss. You know, they can pull out the best scenes and they put a great song with it and all of a sudden I'm sold. But I really like the idea of the world ending. I don't like the idea of the world ending. I just like how that could be portrayed in film. And I was really skeptical about Steve Carell because the guy has not made since The Office. He's not made a good movie, I don't think. I'm trying to think in my head, like Dinner for Schmucks is a piece of shit. Date Night's garbage.
Get Smart.
I have not seen Get Smart. 40-Year-Old Virgin is good. I mean, it's great, but it's not. That's kind of pre-Office or during Office Steve Carell.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is the tack he's taking. And I'm really curious to see how it's going to be. And I remember you, I think I read your review because you posted a review on the website.
It's on our Facebook site.
Yeah.
Facebook.com/@thismovie.
And then I went to like Rotten Tomatoes or something. And I saw, as you said, that it's not being well received. And I read half of an article. And the reason I didn't finish the article because I haven't seen the movie yet. I didn't want to spoil anything or get into plot points. But Vanity Fair called it the worst movie of a generation. And he called it, if not that, the worst movie of the year. And I didn't know if he was being hyperbolic. I don't know this author. But I saw that. I'm like, wow, I must be complete. But I having the knowledge of, like, I respect your opinion and I read your review and it seemed to jive with what I was already thinking about it. I don't understand. And I could maybe see why a person wouldn't like that kind of subject matter. And, of course, I always like the premise of what's the Will Smith movie that is a piece of shit, but I like the idea of
I Am Legend.
I Am Legend. Yes, thank you. That it kind of shits the bed in the third act with all the CGI and all that crap. But I just like this guy who's solitary. I like that one episode of Benson where the Halley's Comet comes and they all turn into popcorn. That's the stuff I respond to. So, of course, in this situation, I'm like, I really would be curious to see how they do this. And from what I read, even your plot synopsis was – very interesting to say Patton Oswalt does this great thing. TJ Miller is at working on a Fridays. It's a nonstop orgy. It's just an interesting, whereas Melancholia to me, I wasn't a fan of Melancholia. That's also a movie about the end of the world. It just was like, two kind of dissimilar parts that didn't really work for me.
Yeah, I responded way more to this than I did to Melancholia, even though I understand what Melancholia was doing and I understand why people would respond to it. the way that this movie sort of approaches similar subject matter resonated with me a lot more.
Sure.
I totally get that, like, divorced from the emotional response that I have, that maybe somebody wouldn't like this movie. Because, again, I'm able to see past that. So if somebody was unmoved by it completely, perhaps they just sit there and think, well, this is garbage, and maybe that's why it's getting such a negative response. But for a guy to call it the worst movie, even of the year, much less of a generation, I just have to think is crazy talk, because
yeah,
if nothing else, it's very well made. I mean, there are things in it that are really great. And, you know, I don't think Steve Carell is great in the movie, because he's just doing the same sort of mopey shtick that he did in right. Dan in Real Life and Dinner for Schmucks, and even what's Crazy Stupid Love, which is not a good movie. but he's fine. I mean, I don't see how you could point to a lot of the things in that movie and say, this is the worst of the year. But again, everything's subjective, right?
Well, even I've not seen Abraham Lincoln's Vampire Hunter, Vampire Hunter. But I've heard that's a big piece of shit too. And it's like, well, yeah. Those are two. I mean, there obviously are movies out there. And I know we try not to kind of, there are bad movies that are not, that don't ever strive to be good. Yeah, and yeah. To call them like, oh, it's the worst thing I've ever seen is like, well, I get that some people pick a movie that is more ambitious to call that the worst movie, because yeah. Then they can make a better case for why it's a bigger failure, as opposed to a movie that doesn't have any ambition, that's a piece of shit and knows it's a piece of shit. Well, calling it a piece of shit is not, you know, revolutionary, but maybe that's why this person is kind of picking this to kind of, but I have not seen it, but I really want to. And I'm a big fan of Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, who's the same director.
Just the same writer.
Same writer.
Okay. She adapted the book for that movie. And this is her first time directing. And I actually was really impressed by a lot of the things she does. There are certain moments in the movie, honestly, where I specifically thought that you would really respond to them. And I won't say what any of them are. But
then again, you also recommended 1408 to me. Patrick was like, Doug, you like horror and you like a lot of...
But you like horror where it's like, you don't really see anything, where things are just sort of suggested, right? And so for some reason, definitely. I was like, oh yeah, 1408 is the movie for you.
I liked, like in The Others, I know you think The Others is fine, but you're not a huge fan of it. I like it a lot. I like a lot of the suggested, yeah, there's a spooky thing and a lot of silences and whatever. And it's like, you know, and I saw 1408. And
it's like, it's not the worst. It's just like, it's fine, you know.
But it is. And honestly, my memory is just like, I want it to be the worst just so I can, the story is even funnier.
Yeah,
but
of course.
It might not even be the worst. I don't know. Yeah.
No, let's say it's the worst.
So Margot at the wedding.
Yes.
your friends and neighbors. what else we got? Don't Go in the Woods. Was that the name of the one?
Yeah.
That's good. You told me, I think that's what you said about, no, horrible. And you should tell everyone to see Seeking a Friend for the End of the World. It's the best of a generation. Your review is.
Let's talk about the movie that we're here to talk about. A Few Good Men.
Love it. Great movie. End of story.
Dunsies. There's a lot of ways we can approach this movie, I think, because this was sort of the movie that broke Aaron Sorkin as a screenwriter, and kind of put him on the map. And of course, he has a new show that just premiered on HBO called The Newsroom. And so he's been floating around a lot lately, including a montage that you talked about with me of Sorkinisms, where somebody took all these things that he does all the time and sort of mash them up into one video.
It's funny. If you, I don't know if you, we can link to it on Facebook, or maybe I'll tweet it out. It's a YouTube video I saw called Sorkinisms, and it's all from his own projects, meaning Sports Night, American President, West Wing, Social Network. Studio 60 Sunset Strip. And it's just how much he borrows. Even A Few Good Men, how much he borrows from himself, not just the themes and the kind of vibe of a conversation, but like verbatim, word for word. And I like Aaron Sorkin. I respond to a lot of how he writes. I get that he's a very stylistic style, you know, writer, but a lot of what he says, and maybe it's because we share some philosophies about cocaine specifically, allegedly. But it's kind of like disturbing, like, oh man, you really need to maybe think outside the box next time, or don't go for the easiest possible thing, but whatever.
I mean, there's a lot of backlash against Aaron Sorkin because because there is so much similarity between a lot of his stuff. Every character is sort of liberal. Everybody talks fast. Every character is basically just a mouthpiece for Aaron Sorkin to, like, get his points across. And I understand that. I guess, you know, I tend to like him too. I would probably rather watch something where characters speak intelligently and quickly. Even if I don't necessarily love everything about it, it's like, well, this doesn't appear to be insulting my intelligence. So there are a lot of flaws, but I'll take it. I have not seen A Few Good Men in a long time. I didn't realize how long until Christopher Guest showed up in a long scene as the doctor. And I'm like, I never realized that was Christopher Guest. Could I really not have seen this movie since before I knew what Christopher Guest looked like out of his, like, Spinal Tap makeup?
Right.
And I never caught the Aaron Sorkin cameo at the bar. So it's been a long time, and this was the first time seeing the movie after seeing a lot of other Aaron Sorkin stuff in recent years. And the sort of Aaron Sorkin-ness of it all, of A Few Good Men, really jumped out at me this time. But the way that I think we should approach the movie is through you, because you love this movie.
I do, and there's parts I realize that are very flawed and parts that really stick out, like sore thumb, that's proper, I think,
yeah,
plural
I think.
Of thumbs. There are multiple thumbs that stick out as if they were sore. But I really do like a lot of it. And part of it, too, is because I respond, and we've talked before ad nauseum about how I like war movies, and obviously this is not a war movie. But I like war movies, and I like militaristic type portrayals. I like when they talk, you know, in movies, when they just following codes and honor and rank and file and giving orders and following things like that. I really respond to that. And I don't even know if I have a preference for courtroom dramas, although this one I think is a pretty well done courtroom drama. Again, I'm not a lawyer. I know nothing about being in a actual, you know, law case or whatever. Law case? but I think I saw this for the first time, I think around when it first came out in 92, it might've been 93 or 94, but I was like, wow, I felt as a high school kid, I was like, wow, this is a smart movie and I can understand it and I can respond to a lot of it. And I even get the two kind of divergent thought processes in terms of like the Colonel Jessup's perspective of protecting America and the lawyer's perspective of protecting the person who was killed. And as a kid, even I kind of could respond to that. And of course, when you're younger in high school and you're watching something like that, you don't necessarily see all the flaws. You don't necessarily see Demi Moore's big giant sweater and her weird hair. You don't necessarily see the horrible scene at the end where, well, I don't, we'll get to the end and spoilers later, but I still love it for history. We've talked a lot before, and if nothing else, this podcast, we always kind of go back to watching things we've seen before and kind of analyzing it with a little more distance and a little more maturity, if you will. But I still really, really like the movie. And I think people, you know, anyone who says they don't like it, I think that, well, how do I put this? I think there's definitely parts that people don't like. And I think the ending is not the ending where all not the climax, but the denouement, if you will, that it's kind of a shitty. I get that there's performances that people not like, even someone on this podcast who has a very clear cut dislike and hatred for the main actor, Tom Cruise. I could see why he maybe wouldn't like that performance, but I think as a project, as a you know, a movie, a thing, it's great. I still do.
I think I do think it works. I think enough of it is good that I like it. I think, you know, Rob Reiner, again, we've talked, I think, before about Rob Reiner on this podcast. he just had a run of like really good movies or really solid movies. And I think A Few Good Men is a pretty solid movie.
Yeah.
It's very old fashioned, which is one of the things, that I like about it. And Rob Reiner was good about, you know, he's like a better Ron Howard, where he just sort of, he was doing these ensemble pieces or working in different genres, but always just making really solid movies. And I think A Few Good Men is maybe the most textbook example of, like, not a lot of style in terms of the filmmaking. He just kind of stands back and he does it all in a very sort of old-fashioned way.
Well, that's, I think that's it, though. I think that's the style. It's this old-fashioned. Yeah. I mean, I was watching some of the shots. It almost seems like the frame of the movie was darker. And again, I don't understand all the technological cinematography aspects of it, especially with film. But the edge of the frame would be darker and the middle of it would be brighter, like as there are close-ups as Tom Cruise is talking to Jack Nicholson's character at the very end. And it's a very old-fashioned feel to me, a vibe to me. But it's a weird mixture of old-fashioned, because even like at the end, this is no spoiler, it says the end and it's spelled out in script cursive. And it's like, wow, that seems to be very on the nose about how old-fashioned it is.
Right.
But it's also a mixture of very early 90s, like the synthesizer score, the, you know, some of the, I don't know, just some the styles and things like that just...
The first time I saw it, I honestly couldn't, like, place what year the movie was supposed to actually occur, because the clothes look really, like, Tom Cruise, his civilian clothes look like they're from the 60s, and there's a lot of, like, older cars.
From, like, a Letterman jacket, yeah.
And so I've just, I mean, I assume that was always intentional, that he's trying to make this thing that sort of feels timeless. And actually, it wasn't until today I had the movie on and I had the subtitles on, because I'm losing my hearing. And, at one point he's like watching a baseball game and one of the newscasters makes reference to Hulk Hogan. And I was like, oh, well that settles it. It's not supposed to take place. That was the first time I definitely knew, okay, this isn't the 60s.
You know, what's funny about that. I've watched this movie. I mean, no joke. At least a dozen times I've seen this movie, and I know people are hyperbolic all the time about, I've seen the movie 100 times. That's ridiculous. But I mean, a dozen times I've sat through and watched maybe even 20 times. I've never even heard the Hulk Hogan thing before. I heard the baseball game. It's like a Cal Ripken reference, which might be 80s or 90s, but yeah, I don't know.
Even that would have gone over my head. But and I only knew about the Hulk Hogan because it came up on the subtitles. so that was the clear cut winner for me. It's such a weird, you know, Aaron Sorkin obviously slants very liberal, and watching the movie this time, I was struck by how he really kind of tries to have it both ways. I mean, there are long stretches of the movie that demonize the military pretty hardcore, I think. And then there's other...
I wouldn't say the military. I'd say certain elements of the military.
Yeah,
because
I guess...
Because everyone is in the military in this
right,
movie.
Well, right. But I feel like when you get to those scenes of, like, sitting around lunch with Jack Nicholson, and it's not just the Nicholson character, see, because you have Kiefer Sutherland, who's, like, a piece of shit also. And so... For a little while, you get a sense of like, oh, this really is like this boys club of bully assholes. Because, yeah, Tom Cruise and Demi Moore and even Kevin Pollak are sort of removed from all that, not just because they're in the Navy, but like they're the lawyers and you kind of overlook the fact that they're in the military. And then as the movie goes on, it kind of gets away from that because then you also have Demi Moore giving speeches about like they stand on a wall and they keep
us
safe. They
say no one's going to hurt you tonight.
Oh,
so,
and I can't stop throwing up in my mouth. And it's not really until the end of the movie, which, again, we're going to be spoiling A Few Good Men, but, you know, You Can't Handle the Truth, for some reason, caught on in popular culture.
Because it's great. I think that line
such
still
a way,
excellent.
In such a way that, like, it's still said, and now when people say it, it's like Show Me the Money, where you just roll your eyes. You're like, oh, my God, what year is this? But at the same time, people still say You Can't Handle the Truth.
Is that your final answer?
That's what I say. Yeah, right, exactly.
but real quick, not, I want to oh, yeah. just talk really quickly about the demonizing the military. And I know what you're saying because obviously the Tom Cruise character, the Lieutenant Weinberg, you know, Demi Moore, they're jagged. They're in Washington Naval Yard. There's whole scenes where they say, like, you and I give an order. It's bullshit. It doesn't mean anything. Nothing's going to change. We're, you know, it's not as important. But these guys are the fanatics about being Marines, and they're the ones that are literally face-to-face with their mirrors or, their counterpart that might engage them at any time.
Right.
There's a great scene, though, I think. And I know what you said before about Aaron Sorkin. He's very liberal. Obviously, the West Wing is, and the American President, very liberal. I don't really know Sportsnet as much, and obviously you can't really do politics as much with sports, but I'm sure there was a leftist slant to that, too. But there's a scene where Tom Cruise is at his wit's end. He's like, I have this code red bullshit that makes me want to punch someone. Mm-hmm. And he's yelling this to Captain Jack, I forgot his last name, Kevin Bacon's character.
Yeah.
And he says, how, you know, you guys and all your blah, blah, blah. And Kevin Bacon's like, don't lump me in with them. Like, the military's huge, and they're fanatical. Just because we wear the same uniform, don't assume that we're the same person, like, that there's different elements. And I think that's an interesting thought that you have to kind of take away from it, that, like, the military is, like, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people with different, you know, there's jarheads, there's idiots, there's meatheads, there's the Kendrick, the Kiefer Sutherland character, who is, like, a stereotype Bible Belt, you know, Southern, you know, whatever.
Right.
And but there are, you know, some good, even Markinson, who is J.T. Walsh's character, who, spoiler, kills himself, which is, honestly, sticks out to me as maybe the, like, I get that why he exists and blah, blah, but it just doesn't, it feels kind of disingenuous a little bit.
Yeah. Plus, I feel like J.T. Walsh is always doing that in movies. Like, I feel like he's always, like, going home and putting on his special clothes and then killing himself. Always. Or he's just being killed. But I feel like usually he's the one killing himself.
Still, to this day, may he rest in peace. Anyway, I just wanted to talk about that. Just how I do think, in a way, it's the – well, I don't want to say the least because I don't know Aaron Sorkin's entire body of work. But The West Wing is very liberal. Yeah. And this, it does try to balance a little bit of both. And there's speeches that Jessup gives. Even though Jessup, Jack Nicholson's character, is very, as you point out, misogynistic. He does this whole horrible thing about, like, you know, if you haven't gotten a blowjob from a superior officer, you're letting the best things in life pass you by. And it's like, I can't believe – that my parents let me watch this. But there's these scenes where he's the man. The buck stops with him, blah,
right.
blah, blah.
Right.
But some of the other stuff he says, if you can kind of remove his slimeballness, some of the other stuff he says about, like, the protection he provides and how, like, his – I just think that is – it's an interesting dynamic.
Well, that's the point that I was ultimately trying to arrive at, that it's not really until the end of the movie where you start to get some of that gray area that I feel like more of the movie perhaps could have existed. There's a scene that I point to all the time from Crash, a movie that is terrible.
The one where he fucks the leg wound.
No, not the sexy Crash. The Oscar-winning Crash, where racism is bad and can't we all just get along? But there's one scene in the movie that actually sort of says, no, a person could be two things, and that's Matt Dillon trying to rescue the black woman that he had sexually assaulted earlier in the movie because he's a racist dick. But he's also a police officer, and she's in danger, and he rescues her, and she's terrified because here's the man who assaulted me. I know that he's racist, and yet he's the only one who can save me right now. And it's an interesting, very tense scene, right. And it's, you know, Matt Dillon is an asshole, but also a good cop and a hero who's doing his job. And that's the only scene in the movie where there's any kind of sort of dichotomy or gray area. And right. A Few Good Men finally sort of arrives to that. I think there's a little bit of it with that Kevin Bacon thing that you're talking about, where it's like, no, Kevin Bacon isn't the same as these other guys, but he is doing his job, you know, and that's right. A lot of what the movie is about, doing your job and your duty. Yeah, when Nicholson finally at the end gives that speech about, like, what you've done today weakened a country, we finally get to that point where it's like, oh, there is this weird sort of moral ambiguity to this, because what he's saying kind of makes sense, even though he's been reprehensible and he ordered the death of another human being and he's on the side of the villains, you know, in the movie.
Yeah.
But what he's saying isn't entirely without merit. And I wish that there might have been a little bit more of that throughout the movie.
No, I completely agree. And I think Doug at 15 or 16 when I first saw it didn't kind of realize how quickly the shift – you're right. They when this whole – when it's kind of gets in the muddy, murky mess of the gray, meaning it's like who is right, who's wrong, is there a right and is there a wrong,
right.
Or is it kind of just all a mess? The movie dips its toe in that, and then as soon as – I think it's the point where Tom Cruise calls him, like, don't call me son, and you're under arrest, you son of a bitch, where we're, like, so quickly sucked back up to say,
right.
Oh, no, we're not going to be in that gray
right.
mess anymore. We're going to stick to the hero is Tom Cruise. And honestly, it would be so much more interesting because there's – the movie starts and, like, we have kind of clearly defined, like – jobs and roles and who did what and what who's responsible. And then it gets just more and more muddy, and it gets to this resolution at the climax that is really intriguing. And then the denouement is just like, oh, no, we got to tie this up in a neat little bow.
Right.
And have it say the end as he like scans the courtroom, and it's very like, no, I'd prefer it to be. I'll make a really dumb comparison. Do you ever? I wish the movie had more of when Tom Cruise finally gets Jack Nicholson to admit that he ordered the code red. Spoiler: Jack Nicholson ordered the code red. When Tom Cruise finally admits this, and it's a whole very delicate, and I think this is where Sorkin is shines. Like, he is able to write these scenes that are like tiptoeing and taking one step forward and like just nudging back a little bit and kind of like pushing and prodding and pulling. When he finally gets like, he works up the courage, and it's a great scene because he's like, I mean, it's all one kind of real time, not one take, but one real time kind of sequence. And
right.
He takes the glass of water and his hand is shaking. It's like, holy shit, he's going to go for it. And he's risking a lot. Like, he's risking losing his profession, you know, his being disbarred and being, I guess, dishonorably discharged, I guess the worst, or maybe even going to prison. But when he finally admits or gets Colonel Jessup to admit that, I almost want the character to be like, and this is the bad comparison I'll make. Do you ever like want to, you probably haven't because you're such a good brother and good person, but like, you ever like when you were a kid, like want to scare your sibling, like you're going to hide in the closet and jump out and scare your sibling?
Probably.
I remember one time specifically, my sister was getting ready for something and my parents were gone. It was just me and her in my parents' house, and it was upstairs, and it's not a big house, but it's big enough where it could be creepy. And I was crawling on the floor for what felt like 5 minutes to get behind her, like so that she wouldn't notice me, you know, taking pains to be not in the mirror and not being, you know, making any noise. And I finally jumped up and scared her, and her reaction to it, I felt instantly horrible. I felt like she screamed so loud and was so like legitimately frightened
right,
that I started
right.
screaming
right.
and I was screaming back at her, and then she starts screaming because I'm screaming. This is a true story. And it was just like the worst, like, this is not at all. Like, I just wanted this to be fun. Like, I wanted to scare my sister and this to be fun. And I think about like when it would be more interesting if Tom Cruise like needs to win the case and like obviously wants to get his, you know, Jessup to on the stand, admit to something, but realizing that like, oh shit, now that like, all of this has happened, and there's such a tonal shift at that moment
right.
where the jury is excused and the witness has rights and he's, you know, basically being read that he's under arrest, where it's like, I wish there was a resolution that wasn't so extreme, like that they're, you know, like these guys could still have their jobs as Marines, that they wouldn't be charged with murder, that Jessup could still, you know, but of course it doesn't do that. It just goes like, yes, I win. I'm the winner.
Right.
Tom Cruise, right. aren't right. I handsome, you know?
Right. Well, right. And again, let's talk about Tom Cruise for a minute because, you know, for a long time, I think Tom Cruise has gotten so much more interesting in the last 10 years or so because he's at least attempting to do some things that play with his celebrity or the stardom that he has built for himself, because through the 80s and 90s, he was great at being a movie star. He wasn't necessarily a great actor. He was just a great movie star. He picked the right projects, and A Few Good Men is a textbook sort of Tom Cruise role, which is the guy who thinks he's super awesome, and then something happens, and he begins to doubt if he is truly awesome. But by the end of the movie, he realizes he's awesome. And that's,
right.
I mean, that's Top Gun, and that's Days of Thunder, and that's Cocktail, and that's, there's a couple other ones that, I mean, it so applies to Tom Cruise. And A Few Good Men is exactly that. And his performance is fine. Like, he's Tom Cruise sort of in movie star mode. But again, watching it this time, I was struck by, he has lines where I think we're supposed to be like laughing because he's our hero and he sort of plays by his own rules and he's arrogant and ha ha ha. But like, he's insufferable, like as a dick. There was one very specific thing that he responds to Demi Moore with early on where it's supposed to be like a joke. And it's just, I just was like, who would ever want to be around this guy? He's just always like a smart ass asshole.
Well, I mean, I
get that that's the character, but I think there's a way of doing it where, like, it's a little less abrasive and a little more Bill Murray.
Okay, and I could see that, but I, you know, you Tom Cruise is obviously not Bill.
But do you know what I mean? Where it's like Bill Murray is so good at like being the smartest, coolest, funniest guy in the room, who seems like an asshole to everyone else, but like the audience is still completely on his side.
Right, right, right.
And
I think about Bill Murray in Ghostbusters specifically, like how he's obviously making very, like he's coming on to Sigourney Weaver's character, you know, very overtly, obsessively, pervertedly, but we still like him and she still is actually fun. I think the scene you're talking about is he meets Demi Moore's character for the first time in her office and she gives him a little speech as she is wont to do in this movie.
Everyone gives speeches in this movie.
Well, it's Aaron Sorkin. And then he says, wow, I'm sexually aroused right now.
That's the one. Because
it did stick out to me as like, that is the worst, you know. But again, this movie is, you know, if it's this timeless, not even timeless, but if it's more of like a boys club throwback to the 50s or 60s or even 80s and 90s, like that might be more acceptable. But in 2012, not to say it was ever acceptable, but in 2012, it's like, it sticks out like, oh wow, you are fired right off the bat. You know?
Right.
But I do think that there is a difference between his performance because, and he's not able to pull off the Bill Murray thing, but I do get that big time, and the character, because the character I don't think is supposed to be, unless maybe, you know, he probably is. The character I would think isn't supposed to be great and everyone loves him, but I think that, yeah, he's probably.
People are constantly, I mean, here's one of my problems with all of the speeches in the movie. I can handle speeches. I mean, again, it's Aaron Sorkin. He writes in these big, long speeches. But so many of the speeches are characters describing other characters to that character. And that's a big pet peeve of mine in movies, where Demi Moore goes on and on about, you, Tom Cruise, are awesome. But here's your problem. You think you're this and this and this and this. Or later on when she's like, the courtroom really responds to you. They like you. You're a great lawyer, and here's why. So you don't actually have to do any work showing who Tom Cruise is as a character,
sure,
because you constantly have other characters telling him who he is as a character. That's my problem with the big speeches.
Tom Cruise, though, is I think that his performance, again, I you're spot on with there is an 80s, 90s Tom Cruise movie star. And to some extent, the 2000s, I know he's doing things outside the box now with, you know, like his characters in Tropic Thunder, whatever, you know, and I'm
that's
actually
not what I was referring to.
I actually find that really annoying. Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
But I do think, you know, I remember, you know, JB on this podcast, numerous multiple times ad nauseum has referred to Tom Cruise as a black hole where a performance should be. And no offense to my colleague and a person I greatly respect, JB, I find that to be a very cheap and easy insult to make towards any sort of movie star, A-list actor. And honestly, let's be honest. It's at this point, it's a little played. We need a new insult for Tom Cruise. If you really hate Tom Cruise as much as you say you hate Tom Cruise, I argue Tom Cruise is not the worst. In fact, you watch him in Ghost Protocol, you watch him in Magnolia, you watch him in Rain Man. The guy can act. And this movie, he's not doing the best performance. And obviously, it's a little more obvious when he's opposite Jack Nicholson, as Jack Nicholson sits in his chair in the witness stand and gives his growling Jack Nicholson, which honestly at this point has become a stereotype and become a performance, a cartoon character. You've got Tom Cruise holding his own with great effort. I don't think that he is at the level of Jack Nicholson or ever will be. He's not that kind of actor, and he shouldn't be. They're different types of actors. But he's not, you know, no one could ever accuse Tom Cruise of lacking confidence. So he just gets up there and does his his thing, and it works for the most part. And actually, you know, maybe I'm defending him too much because of the resistance that I've gotten from JB, where I tend to like him. I tend to, even though I know in real life, he's crazy. He's a Scientologist who's batshit and, you know, is who knows all the rumors and stuff, if it's true or not. I know he's a little nutty, and all the stories you hear, even on Risky Business, when he was a nobody, when that like was shooting, and how he acted like he was Tom Cruise 2012, you know? And I'm like, I can't even put myself in those shoes, but he is, and I think you pointed out, or you said to me that he, well, I'll let you say it, that he's so committed to his performances.
Just that he drags a movie to success just through sheer will.
Yeah. And I think that is, we shouldn't underplay that, how important that is.
Sure. And in A Few Good Men, I mean, that isn't necessary. He's not asked to do that because there are enough other pieces in place that he's sort of an important cog in the machine. But, you know, he's Tom Cruise playing the Tom Cruise part, and he does that fine. it's a weird thing because, again, I haven't seen the movie in a long time, and my memory is like that one of the things it has is great acting. And not necessarily Tom Cruise, but just across the board, because almost every role is filled by a good actor, whether it's Kiefer Sutherland or Kevin Bacon, or, you know, Cuba Gooding shows up for one scene, and Noah Wiley shows up for one scene, and Christopher Guest shows up for one scene, and Aaron Sorkin sitting in a bar, the great Aaron Sorkin, or J.T. Walsh, or whoever, you know, it's a very talented cast. Watching it again this time,
Joshua Molina, keep going.
I was surprised. I don't know. It's not that the acting is bad. It's just that it's a little more serviceable than I remembered. Because again, you have to remember this movie was nominated for a bunch of Oscars, including Best Picture. Like, this is a movie that people consider a classic. And I understand why, because it's very classically done. And it has the iconic scene at the end with Nicholson and Tom Cruise. So I understand its reputation, but watching it again, I was like, wow, Kevin Bacon actually gives one of the best performances in the movie because he's not just laying
it out. I mean, come on, the guy is so good.
Because everyone else is sort of coasting on an autopilot. They're bringing what they bring as a movie star, but that's about it. And I bring that up because you had talked about Nicholson. Yesterday or the day before was Jack Nicholson Day for 30 Stars of Summer, and I watched Five Easy Pieces, which is sort of this iconic Nicholson performance that I had never seen. And anytime you watch one of his movies from the 70s, it depresses you a little bit because he's so great and he's so interesting and compelling. And, you know, especially at the time, he was a movie star unlike any movie star had been before. You know, that was the great thing about the 70s was that, like, Gene Hackman shows up and Bruce Dern, and it's like, these guys are movie stars? They don't look like it, but they're
Donald
also...
Sutherland needs to be a movie star.
Yes, and they're all so interesting, and you're like, this is fucking crazy.
Elliot Gould, why not?
Yeah, Elliot Gould, in the, God damn it, in the 70s, Elliot Gould was the man, and he's another one. It makes me sad when I see him just slumming on Friends. I'm just like,
Ross and Rachel's dad.
You were
so... not Ross and Rachel, Ross and Monica's dad.
Great in the 70s.
Sorry, I wanted to clarify that, just in case anyone's like, Doug, you got the Friends reference wrong.
You don't know your friends. And by that, I mean me. You don't know me.
My only friend, so let's be honest.
So, you know, you just remember Nicholson as being this heavyweight because, yeah, as we've talked about before, your memory of that last confrontation is Nicholson just sits there underplaying and Tom Cruise is waving his arms and, did you order that code red? And it's like, well, Nicholson wins that acting showdown. And I guess he does because, to your point, he's not doing all the crazy gesticulating and whatever that Tom Cruise does, you feel like Tom Cruise is outclassed. But watching it, I'm like, hey, Jack Nicholson is pretty much on autopilot in this movie too.
Yeah,
like he brings weight
sure.
to the movie because he's Jack fucking Nicholson. So he's cast in the role because of what he brings to the movie, not because he's necessarily infusing his performance with anything all that interesting. He's just being Jack Nicholson, and it's we respect him because, hey, it's – I mean, De Niro does the same thing in almost every movie now. It's just like he shows up, and you respond a certain way because, hey, that's Robert De Niro, but he's not doing anything that you haven't seen him do a million times. The only line that I remember really thinking like, hey, good job, Jack Nicholson, was when he asks about Tom Cruise's dad, and he responds, you know, he's been dead for 7 years, and then there's a pause, and he says, well, don't I feel like a fucking asshole? Like, only Jack Nicholson could do that line as well as he did it, so yay. Right. But the rest of the movie, I just feel like he's in default Jack Nicholson mode.
It's a weird thing, though, too, because obviously Jack Nicholson has built
I just want to say Jack Nicholson over – I must have said it 20 times in the last 2 minutes.
He's – I watched Chinatown as you watch Five Easy Pieces. Is Five Easy Pieces the one where he's a sailor? What movie is that?
That's The Last Detail.
The Last – okay. I've not seen that. I want to see Carnal Knowledge again is what
oh,
I want
to – Oh, man. That movie's awesome. Get a job!
Maybe just that one scene between him and what, Anne Margaret? Is that who
yeah,
it is?
Yeah. That was the YouTube clip for the post yesterday.
Oh, my God. That's that so scene. Fucking funny.
Yeah.
He's great. And watching Chinatown and Five Easy Pieces, whatever, anything from the 70s, he's performing, he's acting, he's picking character choices, he's, you know, choosing to do things or not do things. It's not just a autopilot thing. But it's a weird thing because obviously I'm sure doing what he did in the 70s is a lot of effort and it's hard. And now I'm weirdly defending lazy Jack Nicholson right now. It's that a person like De Niro and Jack Nicholson, what they are is they are they're iconic classic character actors or just actors.
Yeah.
And that they've done something so well for such a long time that I'm almost like, I give them a pass because it's like, well, yeah, you're hired, you're cast in this because you are awesome. And you're awesome because you've got 40 years of awesomeness. So like, if you want to phone it in, by all means, Sir Nicholson. However, it does kind of like, yeah, because you do think that Jack Nicholson is sitting back and giving an understated performance. If your memory, you know, you think about, well, Tom Cruise is up there, you know, spitting and jumping down like a monkey, and Jack Nicholson is doing understated. But no, Jack Nicholson is growling and like doing these weird facial tics, right, and chomping on his cigar like a cartoon, like a guy from Popeye or something. And you've got Tom Cruise being Tom Cruise from the 90s. So we're almost unfairly, I think, skewing towards hating Tom Cruise because he's up against a heavyweight, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Again, it's not a – I don't think anybody gives a bad performance. It just speaks to sort of how I described the movie early on, which is like, it's solid. I don't think anyone brings their A game, except for maybe Rob Reiner. but everybody is very serviceable. And so, again, you just want a movie to like work on its own terms. And I think the movie does work on its own terms. It's reasonably well written. Some might say very well written. There are certainly passages that are very well written. There's other things that I think that get in the way.
I think as a procedural, though, it still is a very – and I know that there's parts – and I don't know the law, but I'm sure there's parts that are pointed to and are laughed at by lawyers and
sure,
you know,
or whatever. Or the military. I mean, right, this is a movie that has the potential to offend lots of audiences.
But I think as a procedural, even like the opening – not the opening scene where it's like the little preface where the Downey and whatever Barnes or – I don't even know their names – I've seen the movie 20 times. Lance Corporal Dawson.
Yeah, there it is.
Private Harold
James Marshall. I don't remember.
But they are doing the code red to Santiago, you know, from head of the class. That's who that is, right?
Yeah, right.
But the opening scene where it's a few good men, it's the flag, and it's without music, or it's the band, the marching band starts up, does the Marine Corps song, yeah, and then it
a few does good men, a few good men,
men, men, men, men, men, men, men, men, men, men, men. And then it does that. I don't know what you call it. Drill team doing the rifle exercises.
Yeah,
it's fucking awesome. I think it totally sets this tone right away without dialogue, without whatever. That this is like it's, you know, showing the history and the kind of, I don't know, like just the legacy of the Marine Corps.
Right. Well, it sort of sets up this idea that there are routines and there are traditions and there is order, you know, and everybody's doing this at the same time. Everyone is uniform and they do this every day. And it's like, yeah, that's
all interesting. I just thought it was awesome. I just think it's a great way to open it with the silence and just the sound of like the rifle butt hitting their gloved hand.
Right.
And then it goes to right away. The movie is, it's long. I think it's like 2 hours and 10 or 2 hours and 20 minutes, but I feel like it never lags. There's the Markinson thing in the middle is a little bit whatever, he disappears and he comes back and then he kills himself, blah, blah, blah. But I like how all the beats it takes. I like how you think the court case is going a certain way, and then it turns out that the private first class, or just the Lance Corporal, I don't know, if the younger guy, the white guy that's charged, that he looks up to the other one, Dawson.
Downey
and Dawson, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then it turns out he never heard the order, and so there's a whole monkey wrench thrown in right there that it's just, it's interesting, you know?
Let's talk real quick. I don't think that the movie needs to open with like actually seeing the code red being executed. That adds nothing to the movie.
No. Even at that point too, like now I can recognize their faces, but it's all so dark that all you're seeing is basically
It's
a person being attacked in their bed to bad synthesizer music.
Yeah. I don't know. And I have a theory that like the Demi Moore character is slightly superfluous too. Like, I don't know that the movie is any worse with her removal. I'm glad she's there because, again, at least it's one woman in the movie. And I understand that she's sort of the Tom Cruise. She's like the conscience. She's the one who believes right from the outset these two men.
I disagree. Well, not disagree, but I think that I think that you're right in that it's a little superfluous. But I think that you can make the argument that both her and Weinberg, Kevin Pollak, that both of their characters are in a way superfluous. And there's even a reference to it that now that she's on board, does Tom Cruise still need Weinberg because she is the she can do as much research and blah blah. It's like, no, you're my team, blah blah blah. But I think they actually are the angel and demon on a shoulder.
Right. Well, and that's illustrated in that scene where she says, "Why do you hate them?" And then he says, "Because they're bullies." Why do you love them? Because they stand on a wall. That is some heavy-handed shit. Do you feel like Tom Cruise could have gotten rid of his whole team once he got his thinking bat?
I think so, because you don't put the bat in the closet. Nobody puts bat in the closet.
Let's talk about the ending real quick, and then we should probably wrap up, because one of the things that I've always talked about in terms of one of my issues with A Few Good Men is the fact that there's all this suspense that's there's this fake suspense that's generated where he says, I'm going to put Jessup on the stand, and I'm going to get him to admit that he ordered the Code Red. And then in the next scene, he puts Jessup on the stand and he gets him to admit that he ordered the Code Red. And again, I don't want to reverse engineer A Few Good Men, but all of my favorite stuff in the movie and in a lot of courtroom dramas, which I tend to like, even when they're not all that great, I tend to like them.
I love The Rainmaker.
I do love The Rainmaker. I like The Rainmaker better than A Few Good Men. One of the things that I like...
I have never seen The Rainmaker, but that is outrageous.
One of the things that I like about courtroom dramas is all of these little surprises. And I don't mean twists, because twists are easy, you know. In the best scenes in the movie to me are the ones where Tom Cruise sort of makes a point or constructs an argument that you didn't see coming or that you don't necessarily know where he's going with it right away. I mean, it's a stupid example, but where he gives the book to Noah Wiley and says, you know, tell me where it talks about mess halls. And he's like, well, if they're not written about, they must not exist, right? Or whatever the point is. And I like stuff like that. And so the problem with me with the Jessup stuff is that it's completely telegraphed. And it's fine. I understand that the tension in the scene exists, like, will he pull it off or not? Is he going to go too far? Is Nicholson actually going to admit to this? I would argue that that tension actually doesn't exist because it's a movie and we know Nicholson's going to admit it, but okay.
But I think that it's not so much about the tension existing or, you know, but I think it's that, like I mentioned before, and I hate to use, well, I'm going to be douchey, the delicate dance of how he does it, like how it's earned, how it seems that he brings this guy on the stand right off the bat. Kevin Bacon and the judge are like, don't fuck around. You got to earn this. And if you're going to waste his time.
Wait, they say earn this?
Earn
my again,
but I think that when it finally does like approach it, and I said before, like how he goes back, he goes back and forth, he kind of tiptoes and around it and kind of talks about some other things with the clothing and who you called and blah blah blah, and when he finally goes for it, it feels earned. It feels right. Like we all know he was going to do it, but if he did it in such a way that, like, if it just I don't know how else to say it, but if he did it in such a way that didn't feel genuine, I think we wouldn't like that scene. We would think like, oh, this is just like, you have to do it because it beat for beat how this is a movie is constructed. But it felt a little more like, I don't know. And honestly, I'll be like, when they say the whole exchange, when they start yelling at each other, like, we use words like code, use them. Like, I get fucking chills to this. Like today, I watched it this morning. I got chills.
Wow. No, yeah. I don't think it's a bad scene, and I don't think it undermines the whole movie or anything. My wish is that it wasn't telegraphed. I just wish that maybe we get rid of the scene where Tom Cruise outlines what he's going to do, because then we're sitting there in the audience when he calls Nicholson up on the stand, we are very surprised. And then he starts his questioning and we're like, oh, where's he going with this? What is he going to do? We don't know the outcome. To me, that makes it a more successful scene.
And that speaks to your point too, of just how the movie obviously plays a lot with that in terms of characters talking about each other. They do, they lay out their thing. And I guess you want to make there has to be some of that obviously in his apartment, in the back room of the, you know, like the think tank, how they're going to approach this case, because it is a very confusing, like, we don't know the culture and the history of all the military tribunals, things like that. So we have to know a little of that. But yeah, there's a lot of, you know, telegraphing all over the place.
Right. And I understand that, like, Tom Cruise needs his traditional character arc where he thinks he might not be awesome and then he's awesome. And, oh, so this is what the inside of a courtroom looks like. And it beats you.
All that shit.
Yeah, well, because it beats you over the head, right? With, like, he has to be cocky and kind of lazy as a lawyer, and he's finally put to the test, and he develops sort of this weird morality, and, oh, I'm going to do what's right for the sake of doing what's right, and blah, 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 and he develops courage, and he shows up, he shows, stares down Jessup, and he wins, and all these things have to happen. But there's
the difference between, sorry, go on.
Go ahead.
I just would say it seems like the difference between like an because I, of course, you and I are both saying we want the gray, we want the, the mucky, dirty, whatever. It seems like the difference between like a Sorkin who's speechifying and bloviating and a Mamet who is very understated and kind of like, you're, it's all left up to you.
Yeah.
Like, and that's what I want, a balance of those two things, because sometimes both of those things by themselves don't necessarily do it for me or don't do it as much as I want it to do it. But man, they're both so great. And how could you, you know, they're both awesome.
There's a scene sort of early on, halfway, where he first shows up to Jessup and he's really sort of downplaying the whole time. This is just a formality and whatever. And I wished that his skill as a lawyer would have been more of that, where it, he almost tricks you into thinking that, like, he kind of doesn't know what he's doing.
Sure.
And then he spins it around. And then I realized that, like, oh, that's Columbo. I want A Few Good Men to be an episode of Columbo.
But I see your point totally, because do you watch Veep? Have you seen Veep?
No.
Okay. I'm not going to talk about Veep, but there's an element of Veep where it's like everyone's kind of bungling.
Yeah.
And the, she's the vice president, Julia Louis-Dreyfus. And there's, I'm desperate at this point. I've seen a whole season of Veep, and I want there to be a scene where she kind of, there's a reason why she's there. And I know this sounds really stupid. Of course you haven't seen it. And of course, but the whole thing is like her staff is like capable, but kind of like they screw up and she screws up and they say crazy things and blah, blah, blah. And each week they seem to be stumbling towards the next problem. And at one point, like, I thought it was going to happen during the season finale, where it's like she finally is able to step up and give a speech or do something and to prove herself that there's a reason why she's accomplished this much in her life. And I think that there's an element of that in A Few Good Men, too, where it's like you want the lawyer. I mean, obviously, Caffey's great. He plea bargains everything, blah, blah, blah. You know, he's the best lawyer on our staff. And he, you know, one more, he gets a set of steak knives, Aaron Sorkin. And you want him to show a little more of that, how he's very clever. And it does a little bit. It plays on that where he asks Jessup for the transfer order. But even as they later in, like, the three scenes later where Demi Moore's character is like, why'd you ask for that? You didn't need to. And you did it because you wanted to get a rise out of him. I didn't even get, like, it seemed a little disingenuous where the rise came from.
Yeah, right. Ultimately, this movie lost the Best Picture Oscar to Unforgiven.
Okay.
Do you feel like that's justified, or do you feel like this should have won Best Picture?
Well, you know, I think Unforgiven's great. I'm not a Western I know Mike is a big Western fan. He would argue that Unforgiven's great, and that's the best movie of that year. I personally like this movie more. I mean, I could put this movie on no matter what. In fact, as you and I were going back and forth on the phone and email and say, like, what movie could we F this week? it really came down to, like, what do I want to watch? And I've seen a lot of the suggestions I've seen a bunch of times, but I'm like, I want to watch this again.
Yeah.
And I probably saw it the last time was probably 6 months ago on, like, AMC or something.
Yeah, I feel like there was a story where, like, you turn the TV on going to bed and it was A Few Good Men and you had to watch it until the end.
Yeah. It made my home life very good. but no, Unforgiven's great. Yeah. I mean, I think you said to me, I don't know much about Westerns, but it's the Western to end all Westerns.
Yeah. Well, you know, and again, Oscars are just meaningless anyway. I just wanted to throw it out there.
What else was up that year?
Scent of a Woman.
Oh God, that's garbage.
The Crying Game and Howard's End, which I've never seen because
either. Howard's End. If you told me Howard's End was the same year as this, I would have been, no, Howard's End is 81.
You know, yeah, like, right. Thanks everybody for listening. Remember, you can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com, and you can always email us, which I forgot to say at the top of the show, fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, Douglas, for talking about the movie. It's nice to have you back.
Thank you very much. I hope to be back more often.
I'm sure you will be. Any parting words you'd like to leave us with?
But hoo-ah! Give me some peas! Scent of a Woman.